Blog Talk Radio.
All right, welcome everybody to the Ron Brooks Show, today we are talking about evil again. We started the discussion last week, and we're going to continue this week, and we're going to get to the crux of the issue, which we kind of brought up last week but didn't really get to it, and that is, if evil is impotent, as Ayn Rand says, and she's right, as she usually is, why is it so devastating? Why does it seem to win? Why is the world around us filled with destruction and evil? That's not a sign of impotence. How do you square this idea of impotence with the success? So we're going to talk about evil, what it is again, remind you what it is, and then what Ayn Rand meant by saying that it was impotent, and how is that reflected in the world around us? And talk a little bit about Atlas Shrugged, because Atlas Shrugged, of course, deals exactly with this issue and this was question. Now, I also asked on Facebook for topics to discuss, and got a lot of suggestions from you guys. So if we have time, I'm going to go over that list and see what I can answer quickly and what we can postpone to another time, but what I can give you a quick response to, and so on. So hopefully we'll have a bunch of other topics that we can get to, some of which obviously you guys were interested in based on the comments, although, some of them are topics that I've already covered in past shows. So some of you are commenting on my show who are not listening. All right. You can call in. I'm particularly interested if you've got calls about this topic. 347-324-3075. 347-324-3075. And when you call, press the 1 button so that I know that you're calling to ask a question rather than just calling to listen in. So, we will take... We will take calls, hopefully, about, your experiences with evil, what you think evil is, why you think evil is successful, where do you see evil in the world in which we live today, all over the place, I guess, generally, any questions that our conversation today brings up, feel free to call in. I have a hard time following, Facebook Live while I'm actually doing the show, so it's going to be hard for me to answer questions from Facebook Live, but it's easier if you just call in. All right. So hey, good to have you all on. Good to have you on Facebook Live. Good to have you on Blog Talk Radio. The Facebook Live is available on my page, and you can always access old episodes by going to the video section on my page. And it's Wybrook if you're looking for it. Wybrook.com/Wybrook. So what is evil, right? What is evil? We discussed this last time. We see it all around in the sense of its destructive nature. We see destruction everywhere. We see leeches everywhere. We see people who live, through negating principles, ignoring rational thinking. I mean, everywhere from the president of the United States down. And I'm sorry, those of you who don't want me to mention Trump, I have to, because he's a great example of a lot of what we're talking about. We see it all around us. We see it constantly. And the extent that the good is freedom, to the extent that the good is building and creating and making stuff and producing and valuing and pursuing values, and evil is the negation of that, well, certainly in our politics, our political system is a political system that's become more and more and more negation of values, obstacle to values, and the persecution of those who actually create and produce and make values. And as such, one has to conclude that at least in much of its application today, our political system is evil. And therefore, one has to say, you know, evil is winning in politics. And certainly in contrast to what the United States was and what it represented by the principles articulated by the founding fathers, evil has beaten out those principles. That is bad ideas, evil ideas. Ideas that are counter to human flourishing, counter to human progress, counter to human success, have actually succeeded, have actually gained footing, are actually prevalent all around us. So evil is that which acts against the ability of human beings to be flourishing. But essentially, from OPA, this is how Leonard Peikoff defines evil: the willful ignorance or defiance of reality. So the willful ignorance or defiance of reality. We talked about this last time. This is this evasion, this turning away from the fact, ignoring what is right there, not thinking about it, knowing that one should look, knowing that one should think about a particular issue, and basically, in a sense, implicitly telling oneself, that's too hard, that'll be too painful, I don't want to look there. I know it's important, I know it's crucial to my survival in some deep sense, I know it's crucial to the decision I have to make right now, I know looking over there is what being rational means, and I'm not going to do it. Now, whether that's done really explicitly, and I think sometimes it is done explicitly, or whether that's done implicitly at kind of an emotional level, it doesn't matter. I mean, it matters, I guess, to the extent of the evasion. It matters to the extent of one's own evil. But that is the essence of evil. The essence of evil is irrationality. It's not using one's mind. It's not thinking. It's not engaging with reality. It's not getting the relevant facts for the decision one has to make. It's ignoring facts and doing so purposefully, doing so consciously. So as Leonard says, the willful ignorance and defiance of reality, right? Or defiance of reality. So I don't want, you know, I'm ignoring what I know about reality. I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to ignore the law of gravity and I'm going to jump. You know, that one's good because that one, reality imposes itself on you very quickly, right? You break your leg or you die or whatever, right? But there are lots of places in life where I'm going to ignore what I know about reality and where the consequences are not so obvious, they're not so direct, they're not so immediate. I'm going to lie, even though I know. And every time I've lied in the past, it's boomeranged against me. My life has been worse off as a consequence. I'm just going to do it this one time. And it's not like jumping off a building, because only in the sense that the consequences are not immediate, but the consequences are going to be there. It's going to screw up your ability to live well. It's going to screw up your ability to flourish. It's going to hurt your life. Right? And that evasion of knowledge that this is a bad thing for you, for your life, that is the essence of what immorality and what evil is. All right, we've got our first caller. Hi, you're on the Yaron Brook Show. Who's this?
Hello, am I on?
Hi.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, this is Arjun from Hong Kong.
Hi, Arjun. Oh, wow, from Hong Kong. You know, I'm visiting in a few weeks.
You are? Oh, I'll be in Hong Kong on May 18th. And I wanted to have a second look, but I didn't get a chance.
May 18th to 20th, yes? I'll be in Hong Kong.
And 18th to 20th. Where can I find out on the ARI website, the
events? Yeah, on the ARI website, on events. Okay. We don't have it listed yet because nothing's finalized in terms of what events there'll be, but there will be a public event in Hong Kong. So it'll be listed
on the
event.
April.
What's that?
Thank you. 18th to 20th this month. Okay, I'll
look. No, not
that.
This month.
Thank
next
you
month.
For...
Next month. Next month.
Next month. Okay, next month.
Okay, cool.
I was reading, you know, Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal. In particular, Anatomy of Compromise.
Yep.
So in there, Ayn Rand establishes three principles. The first two I grasp quite well, I think. I understand them both quite well. So the first one, I think, is, you know, amongst two groups, the more consistent one wins out.
Yep.
And then the second one, it's in any collaboration of good and evil, the evil wins because the good has nothing to gain from it and the evil has everything to gain from the good. So I
That's
get
right.
that as well. But
That's
the
right.
third one is a little bit of I don't really get it. If you could help me with that, it's related to this topic. So the third one is that if, you know, if something is explicit, it's in the favor
yep.
of the good. So
yep.
if it's not evaded, and if it's evaded, it's in the favor of the bad. So,
yeah.
Okay, I think I just answered my question, but maybe you can elaborate on this. So
yeah,
I was going to ask,
go ahead.
I was going to ask, like, you know, isn't it a choice at the end of the day? So even if it's explicit, you could still make the choice to evade it, but I guess I got my answer. So you do evade it. So even if it's explicitly stated?
Yeah, if it's explicitly stated, the only way to, in a sense, not see it is to evade it. It's the turn away from it. So you can't. But let me read out, because I'm not sure everybody's up to speed on anatomy of compromise. So in anatomy of compromise, Ayn Rand articulates three principles that she's identified. She said that there are many other principles, but these are three principles she's identified and that she's talking about in this essay. And the third one says.
Oh, sorry. Just a second. I'll just get off the show because I'm
sure,
calling internationally.
Sure.
So
sounds good.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you. So this is the third one. When opposite basically basic principles are clearly and openly defined. So again, when opposite basic principles are clearly and openly defined, it works to the advantage of the rational side. Okay. When they are not clearly defined, but are hidden or evaded, it works the advantage of the irrational side. Right. So again, so if you're in a conflict, right, and the basic principles articulated, right, the rational side is going to win out. It works in its favor. Now, she doesn't say it's going to win out. Why doesn't she say it's going to win out? Because it still depends. It still depends on people's free will, and they are still able to evade. So it's not deterministic, but it works to your advantage. So, you know, let's bring this into kind of the political debate, right? So if long-term, if there are two sides of the political debate regarding healthcare, and one side says, I'm for socialized medicine, and I'm for socialized medicine basically because of altruism, and they articulate altruistic reasons why they're for socialized medicine, right? And then the other side says, I'm for private healthcare, and they articulate the pro-individual human flourishing reasons why they are for private healthcare, right? Then the only way that the socialized medicine can win is to the extent that people are willing to explicitly accept altruism in the face of the presentation of egoism. Now, again, that can happen, and it does happen. But the more explicit the side that's pro-free healthcare is, the more likely it is going to win. Now, Leonard makes this point in OPA. When Ayn Rand and when we in generally talk about winning, it's not about winning tomorrow. It's not about winning today. It's about winning in the long run, right? It's about winning in the long run. And the same about losing. It's not about just losing today. It's about losing in the long run. It's about what ideas, what principles will actually win out in the debate, win out in action, people's actions over a long term. Right? So for example, the what's happened in the debate in healthcare is that neither side is completely explicit, right, about the ideas behind their agenda. So you have the socialists, in a sense, advocating for socialized medicine for almost 100 years, 70 years, right? And they're not completely explicit about altruism because they're not telling people, and this is the thing about being explicit, they're not walking around America and telling people, we need you to sacrifice. You have good health care. You're healthy. We want you to sacrifice because it's your moral duty to sacrifice. It's your moral duty to give up the good health care policies you have and provide health care to those who have not taken care of themselves and are suffering and are needy, because that's your moral duty. They don't actually say that, right? They imply it. They suggest it. It's fuzzy. It's never purely articulated. People don't respond well when they're told, you got to sacrifice. You got to do it right now. You got to live like Mother Teresa. They don't do that. They want to hold Mother Teresa's this vague idea that that's something they should strive towards, right? And on the free market side, nobody says, your moral responsibility is to yourself. It's to provide for yourself. It's to take care of yourself. It's to live the best life that you can live for yourself. Therefore, the only healthcare system consistent with that is a private healthcare system, 100% private healthcare system. If you want to take care of people who are sick or don't have health insurance or whatever, you can do that voluntarily out of your own time and your own money, but you have no right to use force against others. A principled argument about the evil of coercion and but more importantly, morally, the virtue of self-interest, the virtue of selfishness. That never happens. What's generally said is, look, yes, we care about the poor, we care about people who don't have health care, but free markets do it better, and if some people fall off the system, then we'll find a way to take care of them, but let's not cripple everybody's health care for a few. Let's find some balance. Let's find some. Who's going to win that debate, right? When it's all fuzzy and ill-defined, well, the people who are going to win that debate, I mean, other people who won that debate. It's the left. It's the ones where it's the whatever's in the background, whatever's fuzzy in the background, which is basically altruism. Because the reason the free market people are vague about their moral code is because they've accepted altruism and they're not willing to really stand up to anything else. So both are ultimately animated by altruism, but neither will make it very explicit, because you can't make altruism very explicit, because when you do, people reject it. People rebel against it, right? They want to have the cake and eat it too. They want to believe in that they can be happy, and they want to believe in their own happiness, and at the same time hold an altruistic moral code. That's the whole shtick. That's the whole gimmick that altruism has out there. If it's vague like that, altruism is going to win, because that's the momentum. That's what everybody already believes. That's why the free market people are not really challenging it, because they're afraid and because they don't have a clear vision of an alternative moral code. And therefore, what's already there, what's already in the culture, what's already static, that's what's going to win out, right? So it's what it's what's being evaded there. What's being evaded is the true nature of altruism and the alternative, which is rational egoism, right? And that's being evaded. And because that's being evaded, altruism has to win out, right? So when you're fuzzy about morality, altruism will win, because altruism is everywhere in the culture. It's prevalent, and it hasn't been challenged. There's nothing to challenge it. It has to win. The false idea has to win. The right idea requires. So here's another way to think about it. The good, anything that's right, anything that's just, anything that's rational requires effort. Requires thinking. It requires figuring out. Nothing is other than the evidence of the senses. Anything, any abstraction beyond that requires effort. It requires you know, free, it requires implementing actual thought. It requires being engaged. So truth requires effort. Truth requires thinking. So if you're not willing to lay out the reasons for truth, what it involves, what is the truth, if you're not willing, then it's people are not going to get it. They can't go there. You know, so if it's all mushy, then how are people going to get what's really going on? You know, unless they're original thinkers, unless they can think about morality in an original way. So the argument is that in healthcare, if 50 years ago, and I'm convinced of this, if 50 years ago, the free market side had articulated a case for free markets that was explicit, that was uncompromising, and that they called altruism for what it was, and defined, in a sense, a new ethical code, what Ayn Rand would have done, right? If that had been the argument presented, versus if the socialist had been explicit about their own altruism, then I think egoism wins. When egoism and altruism are presented in their explicit nature, in really what they mean, I think egoism wins. And altruism's trick, always had this trick, has always been to never say what it really is about. Never actually advocate for what it's about in principle. Because they know that if they do that, nobody's going to actually advocate for it. So socialized medicine, they never say, look, we know the quality of healthcare for most of you is going to decline, but that's okay because the neediest, the poorest, their healthcare will improve. So we're sacrificing you for their sake. Nobody ever actually says that, even though that's exactly what they want. It's exactly what they imply. And of course, the free market side never calls them on it. Never calls them on it, right? And this is the whole point of regard capitalism. So people say, the free market, say everybody's better off under capitalism. Well, that's not true. It's not true that everybody. So they're trying to say capitalism is good even if you're an altruist, because ultimately everybody's better off under capitalism. Well, that's not true. As I like to call it, the wife-beating drunk is not better off under capitalism. The wife-beating drunk is worse off under capitalism. Now, better off and worse off in the sense of material well-being, in the sense that they understand it, not in the deep sense of objectivism, right? So, you know, he's bad off under socialism, but he's even worse off under capitalism because justice applies. Justice applies. And justice would be more forthright and forceful under capitalism than it is under socialism. So, right? So when it's explicit, And my point is nobody actually makes it explicit because they get it. And particularly the altruists get it. They get that they can't be overly explicit, right? All right. I think that answers. I'm not convinced that was the best answer I could give. I need to think because I wasn't prepared for that particular one, right? But I need to think of a better, like a personal concrete for this. What would be a personal concretization of this principle rather than a political concretization? Ayn Rand in the article primarily provides, if I remember it right, political concretizations of this. Let's see, under three. Here's what she writes about it, right? In order to win, the rational side of any controversy requires that its goals be understood, right? This is what I was saying, it has to be explicit about its goals and it has to be explicit about reasons. It has nothing to hide since reality is its ally. This is crucial, right? Reality is on the side of the good. And this is the whole idea of the moral is the practical, right? If you stand up for morality, what you're standing up for practicality, for what will work, for what is good, what will work in reality. The irrational side has to deceive, has to confuse, to evade, to hide its goals. Fog, murk, blindness are not the tools of reason. They are the only tools of irrationality. The only tools of irrationality. And this is the whole point of evil being impotent, because fog, murk, blindness lead to disaster. They lead to failure, right? They can't produce anything. She goes on to say, no thought, knowledge, or consistency is required in order to destroy. Unremitting thought, enormous knowledge, and a ruthless consistency are required in order to achieve or create. Every error, evasion, or contradiction helps the goal of destruction. So anything irrational, irrationality is on the side of evil. Irrationality is on the side of destroyers. Only reason and logic can advance the goal of construction. So if the good does not present its reason, it's not present the logic of its argument, does not present the facts, it cannot win, because everything the good stands on, what makes it good, is the fact that it's based on reason and logic. And if you can't show that, then you're not really standing for the good. The negative requires an absence, ignorance, impotence, irrationality. The positive requires the presence, a presence, an existence, knowledge, efficacy, thought. The spread of evil is the symptom of a vacuum. Whenever evil wins, it is only by default, by the moral failure of those who evade the fact that there can be no compromise on basic principles. And she quotes from Atlas Shrugged, in any compromise between food and poison, it is only death that can win. In any compromise between good and evil, it is only evil that can profit. She could write. Oh my God, she was such a good writer. People claim she couldn't write. I mean, that's beautiful. And that's nonfiction, and it's beautiful, right? And the way she makes it real. So think of it this way, right? And we're going back to kind of evil's impotence. What makes value creation possible? Makes success, prosperity, achievement, progress possible? And this is true in individual human life, in a social context, in a political context. And again, success, value creation over the long term. Right? What makes it possible to create values? Well, if you're familiar with objectivist literature, what makes it possible is reason. What makes it possible is rational thought. Reason is man's basic means of survival. Just through observation, one can see that every human creation is a product of the reasoning mind. We don't have the genes that allow us to figure out agriculture. We don't have the genes that allow us to fill in the blank when it comes to any kind of creative, productive, innovative thought. Right? It's not, none of that is automatic. It all requires effort. It requires reason. It requires us to engage. It requires us to observe and to integrate and to use our mind. And that's true of everything you do in your life. You need to think, right? If you just try, I always tell students, just try going a day just drifting. Try not to think, not to engage, not to take the physical world, the existent world seriously, just to float through it. Now, I tell them immediately not to do it, because it might get them killed, right? Not a safe activity, and I don't want to be sued by some students who told me, you know, not to look when they cross the street. But, you know, this is what is required in order to be successful as a human being. What is required in order to achieve and create and build and make is to engage in thinking and reason. Right? And that is why reason is a cardinal value in objectivism. Because if reason is our means of survival, our basic means of survival, reason is the way in which human beings survive, in the way in which individual human beings create the values that are necessary for their own existence. And if your life is the standard of value, then you must use reason in order to survive. And therefore, that is your primary value, that which you act to gain or keep, value, reason. So you need reason not to survive. You need to be rational. That's the virtue, the attainment, you know, the commitment to reason, the commitment above all to reason. Now, so if that epistemological observation, if you will, that reason is required for all of man's values, for the achievement of man's values, then what does irrationality achieve? Nothing. It can't attain values. It can't achieve anything. And that's the sense in which evil is impotent. It can't build. It can't create. It can't achieve anything in the world out there. All it can do, all that irrationality can do, all that anti-reason can do, all that the negation of thinking, the negation of reason, the negation in that sense of a moral life can do is destroy. So it takes no thinking to knock stuff down, to blow stuff up. It takes no thinking to destroy. It takes massive amounts of thinking, huge amount of effort to build. I mean, just think of a little kid playing with blocks and think about the effort and the experimentation that a little kid who's, you know, is just starting to play with blocks has to engage in, figuring out basically the laws of gravity, how gravity works, and what block you can put on what block, and how high this can go, and how big of a base. I mean, they're doing physics. How big of a base you have to build in order to build a tall tower, and when you can do a bridge, and when a bridge falls down. All these kind of laws of construction that you know, what the little kid is studying when you watch a little kid play with bricks is really studying physics. I love little kids because you can see these principles of epistemology, these principles of thinking in real concrete, simple terms when you see kids playing and you see kids interacting with reality. And that's why blocks are such a terrific toy. And if your kids don't have blocks, you know, simple blocks, just simple plain blocks, it's a fantastic toy because it requires thinking and concentrating and figuring stuff out. And, you know, way before they get an iPad, you know, blocks, I think, are essential. Anyway, but think about the effort and the thought and the figuring out that it takes to build a tall tower with blocks for a little kid, right? And think about how easy it is and how unthinking it is to knock him down. Now, if some kid goes around knocking down towers, you don't consider that kid efficacious. That is, efficaciousness does not apply to destruction. Success does not apply to knocking down towers. Now, you know, unless you're engaged in the purely physical act of going to war, in a sense, where physical action is all that's left. It's not efficacious to blow stuff up, to destroy, to knock stuff down. That's the opposite. Right? So when you say evil is impotent, it doesn't mean that evil can't act. It doesn't mean that evil can't do things. It's that the things that evil does are not value creating. They're not benefiting human life. They're not moving towards a positive outcome. They are about knocking down towers, knocking down blocks, deceiving, evading, destroying, all the things that lead to bad stuff, to bad outcomes. And even if the outcome is not immediate, even if the outcome is long-term, they lead to bad outcomes because they're the negation of what leads to good outcomes, which is reason and rationality. All right? I don't know. Love to get some calls to get a sense from you whether I'm making any sense at all, because this is not exactly a topic that I'm – this is not my bread and butter, right? So, all right, 347-324-3075, 347-324-3075. Call if you have any questions or comments or suggestions or disagreements or whatever, 347-324-3075. I'm going to take a quick break, and then hopefully there'll be some calls. If not, we'll keep talking about the impotence of evil and maybe go over the list of topics you guys wanted to talk about that I have not gotten to yet. All right. Here's the commercials. Maybe. No. There you go.
2017 marks the 60th anniversary of Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. 12 years in the writing, it is Rand's masterwork. Despite being published six decades ago, the novel continues to gain recognition and profoundly influence business leaders, thought leaders, and a growing number of political leaders. Its presence in today's culture cannot be denied. The fascination with Atlas Shrugged persists because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and presents radically new answers. An updated cover for the mass market edition of the novel recently hit stores. Order your copy today at Amazon. Whether you're an adoring fan who wants to add this new edition to your personal library, or someone who wants to read the book for the first time to see what all the fuss is about, pick up your copy of Atlas Shrugged today. Order on Amazon.
Somewhere in America, at just this moment, as you said listening to this radio show, there is a young person waiting to discover Ayn Rand's novels, waiting to have his or her life changed by the beauty of Ayn Rand's art and the logic of her ideas. Over the past decade, through ARI's Free Books to Teachers program, they have delivered more than 3 million copies of Ayn Rand's books to schools in every state. Right now, they are placing more than 5,000 copies of Anthem, The Fountainhead, and Atlas Shrugged in schools right here in Chicago. Since 2003, they have placed more than 50,000 of Ayn Rand's novels in the Chicagoland area. You can help reach young minds today. You can help reach more students within this listening area. Make your tax-deductible contribution now at AynRand.org/support. That's AynRand.org/SUPPORT.
Objectivist Summer Conference 2017, or OCON 2017 for short, will take place in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, June 10th through the 15th. The conference will be held at this historical center of industrial America and will celebrate productive heroes and the heroism of productiveness. They'll also honor the 60th anniversary of Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. The Ayn Rand Institute is offering a 25% discount on conference registration fees until February 28th. If you want to take advantage of the lower rates, now's the time to sign up. Experience the uniquely inspiring events only an Objectivist conference offers. Register, and you'll have the opportunity to attend intellectually stimulating talks, panel discussions, and workshops with people who share your values. Visit ObjectivistConferences.com and sign up today. That's ObjectivistConferences.com. Students, you can apply for a scholarship to cover some or all of your expenses. See you at OCON 2017. The mission of the Ayn Rand Institute is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. It's rare for employment to offer you the opportunity to impact the culture and make history, but that's exactly what they do at ARI each and every day. They're currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share their goal of raising awareness of Ayn Rand's ideas. Visit ari.aynrand.org to learn more about open positions and how to apply. That's ari.aynrand.org. The battle for philosophic change is a challenging one. It's a long-term educational effort, and a battle the folks at the Ayn Rand Institute willingly undertake each and every day. In the year ahead, ARI is going to educate the public on key matters of policy facing our country and describe the work they're doing, especially with young people, to build momentum for a future that enshrines reason, individual liberty, and capitalism. You can hear from ARI's intellectuals in person about the great work in progress by attending this special event, Building a Future of Reason and Capitalism, in a city near you. Visit ari.aynrand.org/events to learn more. That's ari.aynrand.org/events. Don't miss this special event, Building a Future of Reason and Capitalism. Go to ari.aynrand.org/events for all the details. ARI.aynrand.org/events.
So we're talking about evil today. Is evil impotent? And one of the obvious questions that comes about is that is if evil is impotent, then how come, you know, irrational people and often irrational systems like socialism succeed? What is it that makes it succeed, right? What is it that makes it possible for them to be successful? You know, under socialism, some stuff gets produced, some stuff gets created. It's not all devastation. Now, this is where I would challenge a number of ideas. One, it depends on your time frame. If your time frame is long enough, then yes, it is ultimately all devastation. Nothing good comes out of socialism. Nothing good comes out of socialism if you're willing to wait long enough. Venezuela is discovering that firsthand. Of course, the problem with Venezuela, the primary problem with Venezuela, is that the alternative to socialism is not made explicit. It goes back to our conversation before about in any compromise between, right? So if you don't make your ideas explicit, the socialists will always win. So even though things are horrible in Venezuela and people are dying and starving and eating cats and dogs and they just dismissed the parliament, but then there was an uproar, so they brought the parliament back, but it doesn't matter because it's all one person rule anyway. But the fact that this is that Venezuela is so destructive makes no difference to people. So people in Venezuela still think that socialism is a wonderful thing. And indeed, if you ask them, what political system do you want after we get rid of this creep Maduro and his governing thugs, they say, oh, we want socialism. Even though socialism is what led to this, because there is no alternative presented and it's never been defended morally. So people can't grasp it. They can't figure it out. And of course, nothing is being produced today in Venezuela. Even toilet paper isn't being produced in Venezuela. Now, that's the ultimate outcome. In the early days of the Soviet Union, initially, they could for a while industrialize and create a little bit. But ultimately, they had to starve. And how do they survive even in the short run? They survive in the short run off the backs of those people inside their country who are to whatever extent rational. So to the extent there are people who are rational within a culture and who are allowed some freedom within the scope of their activity, to that extent to which rationality can manifest itself, to that extent survival is possible. To the extent that rationality is crushed completely, as it ultimately is under socialism, to that extent, the culture, the society is going to suffer. The irrationality, the evil, is the impotent part of the equation. So then it's just a question of, is there any rationality being applied? And to the extent that there is, it is the rational that creates and builds and makes something. So the Soviet Union got nuclear weapons. How? By stealing them. So yeah, you can still steal. You can still be a thief. But that's the irrational. And ultimately, the Soviet Union has to collapse in spite of stealing technology for a while. Stealing only works for a while, just like any thief, right? Ultimately, they're caught. Even if they're not caught, their life is worthless. They have no self-esteem and they self-destruct. So one way or another, being a thief is impotent if the standard for the opposite of impotence, being robust, being successful, being flourishing, is human life, is long-term human life. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that in any given situation, an evil person doesn't kill a good person and good has demised and evil has succeeded. But again, it's only succeeded through physical force, through the negation of value, not through the embracing of value. It's impotent in the creation of value. All it can do is knock down towers. All it can do is kill you. All it can do is pick up a fist and punch you, right? So in a human being, we are often mixed. There are areas in our lives where we evade, and there are areas of our life where we're really, really rational. I know a lot of engineers who, at work, they're amazing. But in their personal lives, they're completely compartmentalized. And in their personal lives, they are lying, cheating SOBs. And they can't hold a relationship, and they are miserable people. And ultimately, that catches up to them in their profession as well, in their professional life as well. But for a long time, they can be phenomenal professionally and pathetic when it comes to living their life in other realms. So note, though, that it is that part of you that is rational that keeps you alive, that keeps you going, that makes it possible for you to be successful in whatever realm you are successful. And it is the irrational that leads to failure, to misery in whatever realm you have applied that irrationality. Now, I don't think you can be compartmentalized like that forever. Ultimately, one of the two premises work, and what Ayn Rand wrote about compromise among two different people is also true within compromise within the same person. Right? If you're explicitly good and you want to be good and you've got some stuff that you've just not integrated, it's just not right, you're making a lot of errors in, then the good will impact the bad and clean it up. But if you're doing some good stuff, but the reason you're doing it is kind of mushy and you don't have focus on it, you don't understand why you're doing it and what the basis is and what about reality you need to integrate and so on, and you evade all the time, but you're really good in engineering, you're really good in this field, then ultimately the evasion and the rest of your life will creep into your professional life and destroy that as well. To the extent that the good things happen in the world, put aside accidents and freak events, but to the extent that good things happen in the world over the long run, they happen because someone is being rational and being allowed, as if you should be allowed, but allowed to, you know, exercise his rationality. So a gun is not at the back of the head. To the extent that things are destroyed, like in Venezuela, or like Bernie Madoff, or you know, people who are destroyed, countries that are destroyed, to that extent, they were irrational. They were evaders. They were basically, you know, practicing an evil idea, dominated by an evil idea, whether it's through ignorance or whether it's through intent. Of course, if it's intent, then you evaluate the person differently, but the ideas are still evil, right? But if it's intentional, and it's destructive. So whenever you see destruction on a mass scale, it's a consequence of evil ideas or evil people or both. All right, we got a call. Hi, you're on the Yaron Brook Show. Who's this?
Good afternoon, Dr. Brook. This is Skyler calling from Delaware.
Hey, Skyler. How's it going?
It's going pretty well.
Good, good. What do you think about this evil stuff?
In relation to this topic, since you spoke of knocking down towers, the image in my mind first came to September 11th. And
yep.
I was 13 years old when that occurred, and I could still remember and integrate way before I even knew who Ayn Rand was. Well, my sister read Anthem. That's about the extent. But at that time, I could realize that our enemy took our jet planes, slammed them into our skyscrapers and in the Pentagon, destroyed lives, destroyed property, and it was all based on the fact that they had to use our means. It was
yep.
They had to, in order to exact yeah. evil, they had to implement our goods, the things
no,
that took
we had
years
to produce
making,
planes.
Like the skyscrapers and the planes. It took years
absolutely.
Of thought,
we had to
energy,
produce
and
the things that made the evil possible. Because again, all they can do is knock stuff down. They can't build a plane. Indeed, if you look at the Islamic culture in the Middle East today, they don't even build their own weapons. They don't build anything
no,
that they use
Russians.
In order to destroy. Because they
right.
can't. Because evil is impotent. So what they can do is use things we provide for our own destruction. But of course, the only reason they can do that is because of our own weakness and our own impotence, is because we don't get tough on them and we don't penalize them, right? So, you know, 9/11 should have never happened and would have never happened if we'd taken the Islamist threat seriously, in 1979.
First
reared its ugly head and first made itself real. So evil is made possible in this context. The evil of Islamic totalitarianism, the evil of Islamic terrorism is made possible by the evasion, the negation, the evasion of the good. The good, i.e. America and Americans, didn't want to face up to the full consequences of the rise of Ayatollah Khomeini and the spread of Islamism throughout the Muslim world, and let it just happen and ignored it. And when American people were killed, just ignored that. And that is what emboldened them. That's what made them possible. That's what made it possible for them to use our own airplanes and our own weapons against us. So absolutely. And notice that even a 13-year-old gets that that is evil. And most people get that it's evil. And yet so many people in our culture refuse to call them evil. Right? I remember a philosopher
published Islam wrong.
A philosopher published an editorial in the Wall Street, in the New York Times, I think it was, saying, well, from their perspective, they were right. And it's, you know, it's just our, from our perspective, because they were killing us, it was wrong. But the whole idea of right and wrong or evil and good, those are completely subjective concepts. From their perspective, they were doing good. Now, a 13-year-old gets that that's BS. But
yes,
unless
I did.
You call it, unless you explain what evil is, unless you fight for a rational definition of what self-interest is and what the negation of self-interest is, what negation of human life is, you can't win that discussion. And the guy in the New York Times will ultimately win because the people who called it evil never really explained what that means, why it is, and never completely articulated what that would require. That is, the weakness that George Bush exhibited right after that basically suggested, well, it's not that evil because we're not doing anything. We're dropping food packages on them, so they can't be that evil. We don't want to exaggerate this. We don't want to make this too big of a deal. And of course, if that's the case, then people will buy into the relativism because you have to be explicit. You have to be clear. These are not easy ideas. And so if and a 13-year-old gets it, but they get it at a visceral level, and you've got to make it explicit through philosophy why what they did is evil and why one has to fight them with everything one has. And unless you do that, what you get is what's happening now. And they get emboldened. Evil is succeeding, if you will. It's succeeding because we won't call them evil and we won't act as if they're evil even when we call them evil. We won't treat them like the evil bastards that they really are.
Yes.
That makes sense.
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
What do you think about plata o plomo, or silver or lead? Either you are killed, or either we provide you with some kind of money or jewels or some kind of way, or we kill you.
So it's blackmail. You're talking about blackmail.
For blackmail, yes.
Yeah, so blackmail is all evil. I mean, it's basically use of force. So it's coercion and it's evil and it's wrong. Yeah, absolutely. All right. I've got another couple of callers, so let me take those. Hi, you're on the Iran Book Show. Who's this?
Hi, this is Chris in Phoenix. How you doing?
Good, good. Oh, thanks.
Hey there. So there is one power, if you can call it that, that evil has, and you guys were just honing in on it just now, besides, of course, the ability to exist for short times in a mixture between good and evil before it self-destructs, and to use the good part of that mixture to have some kind of efficacy. There's one other ability that evil has, and that is the ability to use the evil in others as leverage, control them to weaken them. And that's exactly why people didn't just destroy the terrorists after 9/11, because they had irrationalities that, weakened us.
Well, yes, but that's because so it's the evil in us, in the sense that evil ideas, in the sense of altruism, that prevented us from identifying the evil and from doing what was necessary to eradicate it. And what evil benefits from the the fact that the good does not identify and itself explicitly and does not fight for its ideas explicitly and forcefully, and therefore it's left, the good is left implicit, and when the good is left implicit, evil ideas, that's where they have an opening. That's exactly that third principle of compromise that Ayn Rand articulated. When everything's fuzzy, then altruism will win. I mean, there was a short period in which American people said, no, this is ridiculous. We need to fight for our own self-interest. And then they didn't know what self-interest is. They couldn't articulate the case for self-interest. Their leaders completely folded on the idea of self-interest. I mean, George Bush had a few sentences that were good within speeches that were basically altruistic. And that fuzziness, and of course, they never said altruistically, they never said, well, we need to love our neighbor like ourselves, and we need to turn the other cheek. They never said that. We need to sacrifice for the sake of the Muslims. They never said any of that. But that's basically the alternative idea that nobody made explicit. And they drifted into the usual prevalent currency in the culture, which is altruism, which is evil, which the Islamists capitalize on and leverage on. And so at the end of the day, the Muslim world can't produce anything. So all they can bring to the world is poverty and destruction. And we, by appeasing them, only bring poverty and destruction onto ourselves. And so our evil and their evil are impotent and only bring both cultures, both societies down. They only bring destruction to the to each society. And one helps each the other, right? The Islamists are aiding us, in a sense, in our own self-destruction.
That's exactly my point, is that that is the kind of quote-unquote power that evil has, the ability to exploit the evil in the good, in a mixture of good and evil. They'll exploit that evil a little bit as leverage. And, of course, the only problem with this so-called power is that if the good doesn't have any evil, if the good isn't a mixture of good and evil, then it doesn't work at all.
And no, that's, it, to be. That's right. That's absolutely right. So you know, you can do this only as long as the good part in this mixture is weak, doesn't assert itself, doesn't make itself explicit. I think as soon as it makes itself explicit, even in a mixture, then you know, the evil is crushed. And you know, a good example of this is World War II. As soon as the evil of the Nazis was made real as a threat to what was America, it was crush them, destroy them, even though there were remnants of altruism, because those remnants of evil within American society, that mixture, the good was still strong enough to overcome and to be explicit enough and to overcome the bad stuff and to do what was necessary and to crush evil and destroy it completely.
They didn't have enough leverage.
Yeah. So there wasn't enough. You couldn't leverage that, the evil within the mixture, because the good was strong enough in that mixture to, in this particular context, because its very survival was at stake, to eliminate. After 9/11, you could see that America was not the same place, because the response was so different. The response was so much more altruistic, so much weaker. The good did not assert itself in anywhere near the same way that it asserts itself after Pearl Harbor, for example.
Exactly. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Thanks for contributing. All right, one more. Hi, you're on the Yaron Brook Show. Who's this?
Aloha, it's Stuart.
Hey, Stuart, how's it going?
Great. I wanted to ask you, you know, earlier you talked about how, you know, good is creative, evil can only destroy. I wanted to ask you about this environmentalist idea. I've even heard Chicago School libertarians and people who call themselves objectivists voice strong agreement with it. They say every creative human endeavor necessarily has destructive consequences that hurt human beings. For instance, Fritz Haber, you know, the German, found a way to synthesize ammonium nitrate fertilizer, and that saved 2 billion human beings from starvation.
Yeah.
But they say that has so many bad consequences. It causes runoff, and it contributes to greenhouse gas emissions, and it's going to poison people in the long run. And they told me that it's very unfair of you to say that poverty is the default and wealth is created, because cavemen have something industrialized civilization doesn't have. Cavemen have fresh air, but industrialized people pollute the air with their factories, and that's
that,
a reduction
that
in utility
pathetic,
that you don't account
it's such
for.
A pathetic argument. It's such a pathetic argument. I mean, it's not even true that cavemen have clean air. You know, they have the fire, they have the soot from the fire that they have to breathe in every evening. It is filthy. But it's such a rejection of the facts of reality. It's such a rejection of what it means to flourish as a human being. Cavemen can't flourish because they're too concerned every second of the day with their very survival. It's the same thing. I mean, I would argue that it's very difficult for human beings to flourish before the Industrial Revolution, because before the Industrial Revolution, all of our concerns, all of our efforts, all of our time is dedicated to the very need to survive in the moment. That's why you don't get art developing until the Renaissance, or, you know, back in Greece, because again, Greece was a relatively wealthy society in relative terms, and it had a particular philosophical attitude. But think about art, think about all the things that make our life complete, both spiritually and materially, is only made possible because of all the innovation and creation that came about through the Industrial Revolution and gave us the time, the breathing space, the energy to actually focus on what does it mean to live a fulfilling, flourishing, successful life. There are very, very few periods in human history where human beings could even step back and say, huh, I wonder if I'm happy. How do I pursue happiness? Who the hell has time to pursue happiness or to think about what it means to be happy if you have to toil in, you know, to just to grow enough food to feed you and your family somehow, barely? And the idea that cavemen were happier than we are, or that 300 years ago before materialism people were happier, is bullshit. It's the worst kind of bullshit. It's a complete negation, again, of what it means to be human. And so who had time to think? Who had time to use, in a sense, to really think and expansively? All you did was farm and barely survive. So you didn't have time to think about what you want to do with your life and what movie to watch tonight. Or, I mean, it's ludicrous to imagine that with the kind of choices primitive man had, they were happy. So I think the whole thing is stupid. It's just ridiculous, and it comes from a misunderstanding, again, and this is true of libertarians. It's true of most free market people. They don't want to go anywhere beneath economics, and the superficiality of clean air. I live in Orange County, so I live close to LA, right, Los Angeles, and the air in LA is polluted. Yay, I love it, because that pollution means that there are other people around and they're driving cars and they're producing, they're creating things and they're making movies and they're doing productive, engaging things that make it interesting for me to be around. And, you know, if I wanted to live all by myself in the woods, I could go to Wyoming. I mean, that's another thing that only modern life provides you with, those kind of options. But, you know, who cares about pollution when you've got civilization? It's not even close in the high key valleys. Now, you don't want unnecessary pollution. And you know, if there is runoff because of the phosphates or whatever, then clean the runoff. So we clean the runoff, big deal. But to equate those two as if, oh yeah, there's some good, but then there's some evil, is just ludicrous, because the good so outweighs whatever side effects they are. And the side effects can be dealt with through cleanup efforts or through some filtering. Then it's not in the same universe. It's not in the same perspective. It's not human life. Human flourishing is not their standard. And this is because they won't go to morality, and they certainly won't go to epistemology. And if you got anything out of our discussion today about evil being impotent, it's the role of epistemology in all of this. It's the idea that reason is what is efficacious. Right? And it's the negation of reason that is what is the essence of evil. And it's the negation of reason that is basically cannot create, because reason is the way we produce, reason is the way we create. So when you negate reason, you negate production and creation. So this is fundamentally an epistemological claim about evil, about morality. All right, thanks, Stuart. Do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, related to that, a lot of the same people say to me, oh, the reason why Aristotle and Thomas Jefferson and Cyrus McCormick, the reason they had that opportunity to be so lofty and creative is because they had slaves to take care of their material needs.
Yeah, no, that's, again, that is so ahistorical and silly and so on. Slavery throughout human history led to nothing but poverty. They've been slaved for 10,000 years, and yet there's never been a prosperous society until you got to the late 18th century, until you freed man up and you made it possible for them to have the time to think and create and build and make stuff. Now, I'm not excusing the institution of slavery. Slavery is evil, one of the most evil institutions in human history. But nothing good came out of that evil. What came out of that evil is the unfortunate fact that Thomas Jefferson and those guys had mixed premises and probably did not live as flourishing and successful and happy a life as they would have if they'd recognized fully the evil that was slavery and done something about it. I think that, and ultimately, think about the compromise that was the Constitution of America that, you know, that kept slavery. That directly led to a civil war in which 600,000 people died. So there are real evil consequences to accepting evil and compromising with regard to evil. So the compromise with regard to slavery led to horrific consequences in the future. Now, but it's complete nonsense. There were plenty of people who had time on their hands who did not have slaves, and indeed it's quite the opposite. Slave owners were relatively poor as compared to, let's say, factory owners in the North who did not use slaves. Slavery, from a purely economic perspective, is a disastrous, stupid policy. You want your employees to be motivated and to be engaged and to be productive. So, but more essentially, slavery is evil and therefore impractical. And indeed, it doesn't lead to success and flourishing. It's the North that led America to be a rich country, and it's the defeat of the South that led America to become as rich as it is today as a country. All right. Thanks, Stuart. Appreciate the call. Appreciate you listening. So to repeat, right? Evil is impotent in a sense that it cannot create. All it can do is destroy. All it can do is knock down. And we allow it to destroy, to knock things down, only because of our own weakness, only because we are not good enough. We are not consistently good. Imagine how evil would be treated in an objectivist, in a true objectivist society. I mean, it would be shunned on the personal level if your neighbor you knew was an evader, was just a bad guy. He didn't do anything illegal, but he was a bad guy. You would completely shun him. You would ostracize him, and you would limit his influence on you and other people who are good around you. If 9/11 happened in an objectivist world, everybody responsible for this would have been wiped out a long time ago. And the ideology responsible for it would be so coward that there would never be another terrorist attack against the United States. And you people who think how, I've seen this comment on Facebook, how is bombing Saudi Arabia affect self-radicalized people in the United States? You have no understanding of psychology. You have no understanding of what motivates people. Right? If you crush the source, the ideological source of this ideology, if you show the impotence of evil, less people are going to join the evil cause. People don't want to join a cause that is a loser. They don't want to join a cause that Allah is not on their side. And if you prove to them unequivocally that Allah is not on their side, nobody's going to join that cause. The cause will disappear from the face of the earth until the next time the West is weak. They raise their ugly head. Mysticism it raises its ugly head every time the men of reason, go to sleep or go away or default. It has, you don't have to, psychology matters. This is why you don't have to convince every single human being on the planet of the truthness of objectivism. You just have to convince enough of them. And then the rest will look around and they'll see efficacious, successful people, and they will want to emulate that. And they will never study the philosophy in great depths in order to emulate it. They'll emulate the behavior. They'll emulate the morality. They'll absorb the morality in some way. They will never be completely first-handedly good. But the society will change. The culture will change. The minorities change cultures. Not because the majority ultimately learns in detail from the minority and accepts all the premise. Nobody knows anything about Immanuel Kant in our culture. And yet everybody is influenced by Immanuel Kant in the culture. Nobody in a future world, people are not going to have to know objectivism in great detail in order to be influenced by objectivism in great detail and live in a sense and create in a sense an objectivist world. As long as some people, enough people do, and they stand up and they speak and they articulate and they argue and they persuade and they make the case and they don't cower and they don't compromise, so that they model what the right behavior is. So it is only our own weakness. It is only the weakness of the good that makes evil possible. Even their power to knock stuff down is only made possible by our strength. The Soviet Union, Ayn Rand argued, and I agree with her completely, would have been defeated long time ago, and long before the Berlin Wall came down, if the West hadn't helped them, fed them, gave them weapons during World War II. I mean, that was the initial evil. Really, the initial evil was how many Western intellectuals were communists during the 1930s and justified everything in the Soviet Union, how many businessmen and others even helped the Soviet Union during the 1930s. And then during World War II, that the FDR administration sent them weapons and sent them food and sent them help. I mean, the Nazis and the Soviets should have been allowed to beat each other up and destroy each other and show us in great detail and how impotent both were. But we helped the Soviets so that they came out of World War II stronger, more industrialized, because we supplied the capital and the resources to make it possible. And then made it possible for them to kill, 100, 150 million people. And we said nothing morally about them. And then we fed them during the 70s, so-called detente. They would have crumbled. Their impotence would have been revealed much earlier, right? But even when the impotence was revealed, when the Berlin Wall came down, what was the response of so many Western intellectuals? It was, well, communism obviously doesn't work. Certainly the way they practiced it didn't work. But let's not go to extremes on the other side. Let's not then embrace 100% capitalism, because that's just as bad. What we need is what Fukuyama wrote at the end of history. He said, we need these liberal democracies. That's what one. What one is the middle of the road. What one is the mixed economy. What one is the compromise of evil and good. So who do you think ultimately is going to win? The communists are ultimately going to win. And they are winning. And they are winning. Look at Venezuela. Look at the United States of America. Look at where we're heading. So unless the good stands up and not only defends its position, but then articulates the evil of the other position, but has a positive alternative to it, evil will always rise up again and again and again and destroy and destroy and destroy. And we will give them the weapons, because we still produce, we still create, we still build. And this is Atlas Shrugged, right? As long as the creators create, and then get their stuff stolen, but are willing to have that stealing done, indeed vote for that stealing to happen to them, then it keeps going and it keeps going and it keeps going. And what are you doing? You're providing the evil, the evil bastards in Washington, D.C., with more and more resources to inflict more and more of the evil on us. Nobody stands up on principle and argues against it. But it is the good that feeds the system. So Trump wants to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure. How's he going to do it? Infrastructure is just taking money from one pocket and putting it into taking money from productive people in Silicon Valley, in all over this country where people are making stuff, creating stuff, building stuff, taking their money away from them, and then putting it into whatever, it doesn't matter. And this is what the Republicans want to do, right? And as long, but how could they do it if people stood up and said no? And this is what they do in Atlas Shrugged, right? Without giving it away, they say no. You're not going to take my money anymore. You know, I'm going to let evil play itself out. Now, I'm not suggesting what we should do today is what Atlas Shrugged, what they do in Atlas Shrugged. What I am suggesting is that the ideas of Atlas Shrugged need to be articulated. And this particularly to all of you who are apologists to Donald Trump, I say, we have to stand on principle. And we won't win in the short run. We're going to lose in the short run. Absolutely. But if we cave on principle today, the bad guys will win always, all the time, and forever. Well, I'm exaggerating. Because even if we don't stand on principle today, maybe somebody will stand on principle tomorrow. But suddenly, if objectivism is willing to cave on Donald Trump and justify everything he does and apologize for everything that he does and rationalize everything that he does, right? And not stand on principle, not say, okay, and here's a legitimate position. This is the best that we can expect, but it's wrong, and these are the reasons why it's wrong. But yeah, Hillary would be worse. But I don't see even that among his fans who are, call themselves objectivists. They defend everything they do. Well, this is what's politically feasible. But if you don't speak up, if you don't declare evil for what it is, if you don't declare what the right alternative is, then evil will always win. And what you are doing is you're facilitating that evil winning. When you justify everything Trump does, you are facilitating the victory of evil. Trump's ideas, or his lack of ideas on principle, is evil. Whether he is evil or not, put aside. His ideas are evil. And I'm not saying maybe Hillary's was more evil. But you have to declare his ideas as evil. This whole what was done around Obamacare and him accusing the slightly more principled conservatives around Obamacare, that was all a travesty. It was all evil. I talked about it last time, right? But it's exactly the example. If we don't rally around the few people who are willing to be somewhat principled on the area of healthcare, then they will fold. And we will get single-payer socialized healthcare one day, whether it's under Trump or whether it's under a Democrat who will beat Trump because Trump did nothing or whatever, however it plays out in the future. But the one thing you know, that if good does not stand up, if good does not declare its principles, if good does not declare what is right and what is just and what is moral, then evil will succeed. Not succeed in making anything. Not succeed in building anything. Politics is not necessarily about building anything. Most of politics today is about destroying. This is why evil is so successful in politics. Because politics is mainly about regulating, controlling, destroying. It's about knocking towers down. If government was about building towers, then these guys would not be successful. They couldn't be successful. Because evil can't build anything. Only the good can build. Right? So you got to, even if you support Trump, you have got to stand for principle in his face. You have got to declare evil where you see it, from him or from anybody else. If we don't, we will lose. Long term, we have lost if we don't do that. Now, some of you I know don't care about the long term. But that's a problem. That's a problem. You're just willing to give in to emotion because Trump makes you feel good and you think something good is going to come of it. And you're willing to buy that short-term satisfaction of just seeing the left, you know, squirm. And your view is the long-term screwed anyway, so who cares? Well, then you're not my ally in this battle. Because the battle we fight is not against the left. The battle we fight is for the truth. The battle we fight is not a political battle. It's an epistemological battle. Right? And I encourage you all to read the chapter on happiness in OPA, Objectivism, the Philosophy of Ayn Rand, where Leonard Peikoff talks about evil and talks about what it takes and what evil means. Right? And he explains that, again, at the root of this is an epistemological view. and this, some of this I read, and it was like straight out of the headlines, in the sense that, you know, we have a president who doesn't know what a principle is, and we're talking about now a post-truth era. And I'm going to have to do one of the next shows is going to be on this issue of post-truth era. But people have two views of principles: the Christian view of principle, or the mind-body dichotomy view of principle, is, you know, that principles lead to pain because principles about the spiritual world, which is about morality, and in the real world, you know, they don't work. They're not practical. So if you live in principle, and this is what all the movies project, if you're a principled good person, then you suffer in this world. Then this world is not for you. And indeed, this is, we talked about this last time, movies always present the bad guy as having a life, as enjoying life, as cool, as getting the goals, as smiling all the time, as having fun, you know. And the good guy, because he's good, not as an accident, because he's good, because he's trying to be principled, is a loser, is pathetic. Now, this is all derives from metaphysics, from the mind-body dichotomy, from the idea that the spiritual, soul body or whatever, right? The spiritual is the realm of principle, and it doesn't apply to the material, which is a dirty realm anyway. So the evil can have the material world. Yes, the evil does very well in the material world. They're creative, they're innovative, they think big thoughts, right? And, you know, that's the mind-body that come in. And then the alternative to that, the only alternative is what principles? Who cares about principles? Principles don't relate to what works. So what we need is only to do what works. This is Donald Trump. This is the post-truth era. Truth doesn't matter. Reality doesn't matter. Facts don't matter. Principles certainly don't matter. All that matters is what works. And what works is what works right now. And if I have to lie in order to get something to work, that's what my, and it isn't even what works, because in the Donald Trump era, what works is what wins. If I win an election, whatever it takes to win an election, you know, to get people to love me, whatever it takes to make people love me. And it's not particularly thoughtful in terms of long-term, because it's anti-thought. So it's the rejection of facts, the rejection of reality, the rejection of truth, the rejection of principle for the sake of the short term. And those are the two, what works in the short term. Those are the two alternatives presented: mind-body split versus complete subjectivism, pragmatism / subjectivism, whatever works. Intrinsicism versus subjectivism. Mind-body split leads into two things. One is, you know, principles, either way, principles are detached from reality. So you either live a principled life and you suffer, or you become a complete pragmatist and you abandon principles. Those are the alternatives we have. And it takes a genius like Ayn Rand to reconceive epistemology, to come up with a proper conception of the objective, of what reason is and the efficaciousness of reason, to create a harmony between the mind and the body, that they're not in opposition, they are one. A harmony between the moral and the practical. Why? Because of the mind-body harmony, because reason is efficacious. Only because reason is efficacious in this world, in the material and spiritual world. It's the efficaciousness of reason that makes the moral the practical. And the practical is the mall. What works long term is the mall. And what's mall will work. Evil is the opposite of that. Evil doesn't work. And what doesn't work is evil. All right. Hopefully that was interesting. Stretching a little bit. Not easy, right? So I encourage you again to read the chapter on happiness from Opal. Generally, if you guys out there have not read Lenin Peikoff's Objectivism, the Philosophy of Ayn Rand. It's a must, and there's no excuses because it's available. I mean, when I discovered Objectivism, when I discovered Ayn Rand, there was no OPA, and it was very hard. And to figure out that there's a what the philosophy is and how the philosophy is integrated and how it's a whole and what it actually means and how it all fits together and integrates was very, very difficult. It may be impossible, and I'm not sure I had it until I read OPA. OPA puts it all together, really allows you to integrate it fully into your soul, really allows you to integrate it fully into what you are, right? And you got to read it, and you got to read it slowly, and you got to think about it. If you get a group of friends, get a study group going. Get a study group going, right? So, yeah, I hope this was interesting for you guys. A little outside of the, well, it's philosophy, you know, at the end of the day. I am not a philosopher. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Hopefully lots of people will listen to it. Hopefully you share it, you tweet it, you do everything. Here's a movie recommendation that I think illustrates everything we talked about today. Well, in a sense. I mean, it's one of my favorite movies of all time. And it's a movie that I discovered by accident, flipping through channels before there was Netflix, before there was anything like that. There's a review of the movie that I wrote many years ago online. And you can find it. Let me just find the review. No, that's not it. Anyway, okay. I can't find it, but the movie is This Land Is Mine. It was made in 1943 as basically, quote, a propaganda movie. It was directed by Jean Renoir, who made a lot of not so good movies, or very artistic movies, but not so very good movies theme wise. But this movie is brilliant. This is, again, one of my favorite movies. It has one of the best acting performances that I know ever, right? At least based on my knowledge and granted my limited knowledge of cinema or the art of acting. But one of my favorite actors, Charles Laughton, he is a central character. It's with Maureen O'Hara, George Sanders, an amazing list of character actors in this movie. It was made in 1943. And it's about a – and it's very stylized, very, very stylized, very abstract in the sense that it's set in a it's not This Land Is Your Land. This Land Is Mine is the name of the movie. This Land Is Mine. If you go to IMBD, you can find it. And I don't know where you can see it. It's hard to find. It's on Turner Classics once in a while. I think that's where I got it. This Land Is Mine, 1943, Charles Laughton, right? Jean Renoir is the director. And it's set in an unidentified town in an unidentified country that the Nazis have occupied, right? And it shows how impotent the Nazis are. And that their only ability to be successful is through the sanction of the good. The town mayor of, and I haven't seen the movie in quite a while, I should see it again. The town mayor and others who facilitate their ability to control the town. And it shows, you know, how the whole intricacy and the whole, you know, the people who work with the Nazis versus the people who just turn the other cheek or just evade or just pretend. And then there's the character who starts out basically as a coward, an utter coward, and lands up as one of the most heroic people that I've ever seen on the movie screen. Not in action, but in spirit. And heroic on so many different dimensions. It's so many different layers, right? Heroic because he stands up to the Nazis. Heroic because he's willing to tell the woman he loves, who clearly doesn't love him, but the woman he loves, that he loves her after the whole movie he's been cowering away from it. Heroic in terms of willing to tell the townspeople what he really thinks of them and what their real evil is. Heroic in the sense that he's willing to identify the sanction of the victim. He identifies that the Nazis cannot survive in this town without the help of the townspeople. And the way in which the townspeople help the Nazis is concretized in so many different ways. So many different ways. It's a truly what movies should be about. Now, it's black and white, and some of you will hate it because it doesn't have action scenes every few minutes and no explosions, one little explosion, and no car chases, and none of the – and no superheroes. Indeed, the hero is an overweight, middle-aged, ugly guy, right? That's Charles Laughton. But he is so heroic, in my view, anyway. Anyway, this is a must – one of my top five movies of all time – one of my favorites, and you can get it on Amazon. And This Land Is Mine, and I did write a review of it, and it's on lindamann.com. But if you look This Land Is Mine and put my name, this website will come up. And you know, what can I say? Everything about the impotence of evil is in the movie. Everything about the sanction of the victim is in this movie. And it's so well dramatized and it's so well acted that it is one of my, I won't say it's a great movie because, you know, I'm not an expert in aesthetics, but it's one of my all-time favorite movies. And I encourage you to watch it and enjoy it. And, you know, great movies were made in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. You know, you really have to get to know those old movies to know what's possible with theater. All right, that was cinema. I will see you next week. It won't be on Saturday. It will be on a Sunday, probably. I'll probably be doing this from London on Sunday. And I'm pretty sure the topic will be Islam. What are we supposed to do about it? So for all you Islamophobes and all you those you who love Islam and everybody in between, we will dissect the whole issue next show. All right. Good talking to you. Have a great week. For what is-